Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm very pleased to invite back to the program today Ian Rankin. Hello, Ian.
Hey, nice to talk to you again, Vic.
Ian, you've answered our prayers. You've written another Rebus book. It's called Standing in Another Man's Grave. We're so glad.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much people were missing the old fella until I brought him back, or until I said I was bringing him back. And then, you know, there was this just, you know, wave of enthusiasm for the project. But, you know, as you know, the reason I stopped writing the books wasn't that I was fed up with him, tired of writing about him, bored of him. It was just that he had reached retirement age. And when I found a way to bring him back, I brought him back.
Well, the last time we had you on the program, you indicated you might find some way to get him back. And he's back in a very different role. And this is really fun to have him sort of be retired. But he can't stay retired, can he?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the two things happened. One was that, you know, I discovered there was this unit in Edinburgh that deals with cold cases, and it's staffed by three retired detectives and one serving officer. And I thought, well, this is perfect for Rebus. This is what he's been doing ever since he retired. He's one of those retired detectives. The second thing that happened was they started to talk about changing the retirement age, because it used to be that detectives in Scotland had to retire at 60, and now they're talking about changing that to 65, maybe even 67. So I said to a cop friend of mine, could Rebus apply to come back in? And he went, yeah, of course he could. But if he did, he would be vetted by the Internal Affairs. I thought, oh, well, now suddenly I've not just got Rebus in this book, but I've got my other character, Malcolm Fox, as well.
And the Internal Affairs, the complaints.
Yeah.
You found a way to weave them into this book as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I haven't spent two books letting people get to know Malcolm Fox and thinking he's a nice guy, he's a good guy. I wanted to turn that on its head and say to people, yeah, but if you're a cop like Rebus who's been investigated by Malcolm Fox, suddenly Fox doesn't look like the good guy anymore. He's really tough, he's persistent, and he wants to bring you down. So we get to see a much harder, tougher side of Malcolm Fox's personality. And of course, because the vast majority of readers, I guess, want Rebus to succeed, want Rebus to come back into the force, that means Malcolm Fox has to be the bad guy, because he's trying to stop that from happening. So we've got Rebus as the protagonist, and for once, Malcolm Fox is the antagonist.
And of course, Rebus is a perfect target for the complaints, because the guy's going out and having drinks with Big Jer Carfady all the time.
Yeah. And that's one of those interesting relationships, the kind of villain who used to run Edinburgh but is now a bit of a dinosaur, and a cop who used to be very active in Edinburgh but is now a bit of a dinosaur. The two of them, there's an empathy there between them. I mean, not sympathy, but empathy. And you're never sure when they go for these drinks, are they going out as friends, or just below the surface, is there something happening? Is each man trying to bring down the other guy? So there's all this sort of jousting that's going on that's just below the surface of this apparently pleasant evening out going for a few drinks.
I think Rebus makes it pretty clear they're not friends.
Yeah, I think so too. But he understands Cafferty, and he knows that Cafferty has a moral code. And in this book, Rebus comes up against some younger, hungrier gangsters, villains, who have no moral code whatsoever.
Your books featuring Rebus quite frequently have a lot of music in them, and Rebus is kind of like a vinyl LP, isn't he?
Yeah, I think I say it in this book, actually. Somebody says to him he's a vinyl guy in a digital world, because, you know, this book brings him into a missing persons inquiry. It's a young person who's gone missing. Therefore, the police use all the social media at their disposal, Facebook and Friends Reunited and Twitter. And a young cop has to try and explain to Rebus exactly what Twitter is.
Mm-hmm.
And he just doesn't get it at all. You know, he's a vinyl guy. His idea of policing is to have contacts, to meet people face to face, to look them in the eye so you can tell if they're lying or not. He has no time for all this new technology. He knows it's useful, but he is in a place in his head where he just can't bring himself to use it. He still prefers to use the old ways, which is why I say that he's a little bit of a dinosaur. And that's partly why Malcolm Fox doesn't think Rebus would make a good cop these days, is because policing has moved on so much since Rebus's heyday, which would have been the 70s and 80s.
And you've gotten your title, Standing in Another Man's Grave. It's been inspired by a song and an artist that you have a particular fondness for.
Yeah, I mean, Jackie Leavin is a guy whose music I thought Rebus would like. So, and he's a Scottish singer-songwriter. He writes very muscular, poetic songs about hard men and men who can't show their feelings and who've fallen in and out of love. I thought Rebus would be a fan of this music. So I mentioned it in one of the books. I didn't know that Jackie was a fan of the books. He was amazed to see himself mentioned. He got in touch with me. We became good friends. We made an album together. We toured together. And then just as I was starting to write this new book, he died unexpectedly. And it was a shock to the system. And I was listening to a lot of his music while I was plotting the book. And there was a song in it. And I thought he was singing that he was standing in another man's grave, standing in another man's grave. And when I went and checked the lyrics, I was mishearing it. It was standing in another man's rain.
Mm.
But by then I had my title. I just thought it's a great title. And I went to my publisher very excitedly and said, I know what the title of my next book is. And I told him, and he said, no, you can't have that. It's far too long. It won't fit in the front of the jacket. So I went away and did some research, and I discovered it is exactly the same number of characters as the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Nice.
So I went back to my publisher and said, look, it didn't do Stieg Larsson any harm. And so he caved in. He admitted that I could have that as my title.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the crime, what Rebus is working on.
Well, it's he works cold cases, and I got the initial idea I got for this book was it was a crime novel, but not with cops. It was about a parent whose child vanished a decade before, and they're unable to put it behind them. They're unable to give up the search. They start to mythologize what might have happened to their child. And when I got to think about it, I saw it as a road movie. I saw the parent going up and down the same stretch of road where their child had last been seen, and getting to know the road and getting to know the people who use it, people that live near it, who work there, who travel up and down it every day. And then I thought, well, the parent would obviously go to the cold case unit and make sure the police still had an active interest in this investigation, that they hadn't given up. And that's when I suddenly thought, wait a minute, Rebus works cold cases. That's what he's been doing since he retired. So this is beginning to look very much like a Rebus novel. And I took it from there. And it takes Rebus out of his comfort zone because this stretch of road that I use is the spine. It runs up the spine of Scotland, and it takes him far away from Edinburgh up into a land that he doesn't really understand, to show him that there's more to Scotland than the very narrow perimeter that he's used to policing. And, you know, I'm writing it at a time when Scotland itself is changing, when there's talk of independence, breaking away from the United Kingdom. So a lot of us are beginning to question what kind of country it is. Is it a more complex country than we really have thought in the past? And some of that I can throw at Rebus and let him do my thinking for me, maybe come to a few conclusions.
Ian Rankin joins us. His new one is Standing in Another Man's Grave, and this really is a Rebus road novel. He's out there in his trusty Saab. He loves that car, doesn't he?
It's a bit like him. It's battered. It's got a few miles on the clock, but it just keeps on going.
We have also his relationship with Siobhan, and it's very different now, yet it's very much the same, isn't it?
Well, you know, when I start to think, oh, this new novel is going to be a Rebus novel, I thought, okay, is there a place for Siobhan? Is there a place for Cafferty? And I thought, yeah, you know, Siobhan has prospered since she moved from beneath Rebus's shadow. She's been able to make her own way in the police. She's got her own personality. She's been promoted. She's running her own cases. So she's going to have very mixed feelings when this guy from her past comes back, because she knows that in the past that means trouble. And if the trouble happens to involve her, even tangentially, it may affect her chances of being promoted further up the ranks. So, you know, I wasn't sure how she would feel about it. I mean, on the one hand, he's like been like an uncle to her, or, I mean, almost like a father to her throughout the course of the series. So, of course, she's pleased to see him, but she knows that if she allows him to get too close to the case that she's working on, that he will start to interfere in ways that might not be good for her and for the case. So there's an interesting relationship, their relationship. And it was a real pleasure to kind of explore it a little bit further and to see how she had changed as an individual. And then, of course, Malcolm Fox comes along and says to her, look, you mustn't let this guy Rebus get too close to you, because in the past he's been trouble and he will prove to be so again. So, you know, help me to stop him rejoining the force, because he doesn't belong here anymore. So she's got very mixed emotions about the whole thing, and it was fun to explore that. It was fun to sort of challenge my own preconceptions of the kind of character she was.
And in typical fashion, Rebus quickly ticks off almost every superior, but he does have one that kind of protects him.
Yeah, I mean, partly that's... I mean, the chief constable, the chief of police in Edinburgh, this is partly because the real chief of police, several years ago, reviewed one of my books in a newspaper, and he said, I wish I had one like Rebus on the force. There's room for one maverick in every police force, one loose cannon, one free thinker, someone who's absolutely dedicated to the job, but has their own way of going about things. And so I thought that guy, that chief of police, would be on Rebus's side. We never meet him in the book. He's just a kind of, he's a presence. But he protects Rebus to a certain extent. It'd be interesting to see what happens next. As I sit talking to you, I'm thinking, has Rebus rejoined the force? Is he working as a detective again? Because the cold case unit that he works for, which is real, is just about to be wound up. Because the whole structure of the policing, the nature of policing in Scotland is changing radically from the 1st of April. And they would have to choose April Fool's Day to make these changes. And instead of having 8 regional police forces, we're going to have 1 police force for the whole of Scotland. And so I'm having to talk to a lot of senior cops and say, look, how's this going to affect internal affairs? How's it going to affect someone like Rebus, who's applied to come back in? You know, how many people will be left at the top? The chief of police in Edinburgh will disappear. That actual role will disappear. So there's quite a lot of stuff that I've got to get right before I start the next book.
Well, you do introduce a young, actually a teenaged character who seems to be the next up-and-coming crime kingpin. So I'm guessing we're probably going to see this guy again.
Well, you know, I think there's room for, he's an intriguing character. It's one of these things, Vic, when I start a book, I'm not always sure where the book is going to go. There's going to be an adventure for me here because I've no idea how these characters are going to affect me and affect the plot. So he was introduced as a fairly... This is the brother of the missing girl who's gone missing in the current and in the contemporary times. And he was a minor character. He was a member of the family. I thought, well, you know, his mother is very emotional about the whole thing, so he's having to grow up very quickly. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute. Maybe he's kind of the junior to this guy who's a bit of a villain, and maybe he's looking to better himself and improve his situation by leapfrogging this guy. And he started to get darker and darker as the book wore on, and I began to see him as a much more interesting character. There was more that I could do with him than I envisaged when I first invented him. So when we first see him, he's at a press conference. And at that point, when I was writing the first draft, that was pretty much the only role he was going to play in the book. And then I had this kind of lightning moment where I thought, wait a minute, what if he does this? What if he's connected to that guy? And what if this happens? And I saw a role for him that I hadn't envisaged originally, and that was very exciting. And as you have suggested, I think there's room for us to see more of him in the future.
Mm-hmm. Ian Rankin joins us. His book is Standing in Another Man's Grave, and it marks the return of Inspector John Rebus, no longer inspector, now retired, but still a troublemaker who does his best thinking about solving crimes with his glass of single malt and the vinyl spinning on the player. You still there?
Yeah. Sorry, was that a question? Was there a question there? The thing is that, Rebus is very unlike me in many ways. He wouldn't like me if he met me. If he walked into the Oxford Bar, which is where I drink and where he drinks, the only thing we have in common really is our love of vinyl and our interest in Edinburgh as a city and as a place that inspires us. And so we would talk about music for quite a while, but then we would have to go our separate ways because our way of looking at the world is different. And I sometimes feel the thing we have in common is I do often feel like I'm an analog guy in a digital world. You know, I mean, I'm still buying vinyl. I still have an old record player that I had for, I don't know, 30 years that I play my records on. I don't, you know, the newfangled technologies, my laptop computer that I use is so old that it's basically got a wood-burning stove at the back that I fill up every day before I get it going. You know, it has no internet connection. I don't know what kind of software it uses, but it's very out of date. But it gets the job done. So it's like Rebus with a Saab, me with my computer, me with my record player. We just like stuff that keeps on going, that keeps working. And that's very comforting when there are these things, these solid things in your life. I like everything about the tactile experience of reading a book or picking up an LP. This digital stuff just doesn't do it for me in the same way. There isn't the emotional attachment. So I'm with Rebus on that.
So you are a little bit like Rebus. And as we're going through the book, those of us that are into the music, we're always looking for those musical references. And we'll see Rebus turn on the radio and he'll say, oh, they're playing a song by Maggie Bell, and I flash back to Stone the Crows and how much I love that band. And it's just really, it's a pleasure for those of us who are into music to read these.
I've always got to be careful that it's his musical taste and not mine, because he's a generation older than me. So when I was younger, Stone the Crows kind of passed me by. I didn't really start listening to them until I was in my 20s or 30s. But I knew that they would be the right period for Rebus. And he likes that kind of blue-collar sound, you know? And Stone the Crows definitely had it. Rory Gallagher had it, which is why he listens to Rory Gallagher as opposed to a more esoteric guitarist. It's why he prefers the Stones to the Beatles. There was just something more kind of just, you know, straight-ahead rock sound about them, not affected in any way. So, yeah, I mean, I do like the music he likes, but I've always got to be careful that I'm not giving him my musical taste, that it is his musical taste.
Well, and sometimes it takes a while, doesn't it? Because the first time you listened to Let It Bleed, you didn't get it, did you?
No. I mean, I was 10 years old and or 11 years old, and I was listening to T-Rex and Slade at the time, and this meant nothing to me, these songs about, I don't know, kind of dissolute reprobates and their nefarious practices. I didn't get some of the references. It passed me by. But it must have, subconsciously, it crept beneath my skin and stayed there, because a few years later, when I saw the vinyl in a shop, I bought it, and it became, you know, possibly my favorite album of all time. It just took a little while.
Ian Rankin joins us. His new novel is Standing in Another Man's Grave, and he just came from WNYC, where he did an interview on a music show and talked about some of his musical loves. And I saw a piece you wrote, I think it was in Quietus recently, where you said that Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures album, you could feel inspired to write a novel about it.
I took notes, yeah. I mean, it's one of these albums that I really got into in a big way when I was a teenager. And then I got hold, because there's no lyrics with it, and I'm terrible for mishearing lyrics, but I did get hold of the lyrics for the songs. And I started to compose a kind of novel in my head, with each track being a chapter of the book. And I found a kind of theme. I found something running through it. I found a character I could use. It was good. The novel was going to be about a professional assassin who's come to a strange city, a city he doesn't really know, at dead of night. And he's kind of looking for the person he's supposed to kill. And he's going through the streets. And he's staying at a kind of sleazy hotel, etc., etc. And I would pluck little couplets out from the various songs. And I started to thread this narrative around them, but haven't done it in my head and taken some notes. That was as far as I ever got with the project, partly because it would have been a very different kind of book from the stuff I was writing, and partly because I couldn't be bothered with all the permissions that I would have to get to use the lyrics.
Have you read Peter Hook's memoir about Joy Division?
Yeah, I have, and also Deborah Curtis's book about her time with Ian Curtis, the lead singer in the band, which is an excellent book as well. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a sucker for a rock biography or a rock book. I mean, you know, give me Keith Richards or Pete Townsend or Neil Young's book, and I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm just, what I really want, most of all, is a David Bowie book. I want David Bowie to write his book.
Ah, well, that's probably due any time. You almost saw Joy Division, didn't you? They were with the Buzzcocks.
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine came to my, I was a student, and a friend came to the door and he said, look, I'm going to see the Buzzcocks, and they're supported by this band called Joy Division. I'd never heard of Joy Division at that time. I wasn't a huge fan of the Buzzcocks. I had an essay to write for my English degree. I said, nah, I'll just stay home. And then I got to hear the Joy Division album, the first album. I bought it. They were coming to Edinburgh to play at a tiny club, so I got my ticket. It cost me 50 pence, which I don't know how many cents that is. It's not very much at all. But, of course, Ian Curtis killed himself before that show could ever take place. And I could have taken my ticket back to the venue and got my money refunded, but I hung on to it. So framed on my wall in my office is my Joy Division ticket for a show that I never saw.
And, of course, there was that thing where people thought that there were Nazi overtones or fascist overtones.
Yeah.
And you ran into that yourself when you were a throbbing Gristle fan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember wearing my badge, my throbbing Gristle badge, which was like a kind of black and red stripes with a little lightning bolt through it. And I was wearing it to university one day, and a female member of staff said, "Why are you wearing that Nazi badge?" And I said, "Is it Nazi? I didn't know." She said, "Well, it looks like it is. It looks like some kind of fascist design." And I hadn't realized that. And that when I looked at the kind of the imagery around the band, there were elements of that. I mean, it was a confrontational band. It was almost like an art project to try and shock you. That made them interesting. And when you're 18, 19, as I was, and I was a fairly brooding personality, quite a dark personality. I like to dress in black and wear shades indoors, you know, always stuff that young tortured men like to do when they're that age. The music they played seemed to sum that up. But just recently I've got to kind of know Cozy a little bit, and she sent me some music that she'd done, and she found out I'd been a fan of the band and stuff, and we sort of corresponded via Twitter. And, you know, and her and Chris Carter, her partner, are just really nice people. But again, if you'd looked at the early iconography of that band, you would have thought, these are very dangerous individuals. They're a danger to the state, and they probably should be locked up.
Well, Genesis certainly seemed like a danger.
It possibly still does, yeah. Yeah.
Ian Rankin joins us. Standing in Another Man's Grave is his new novel. We've digressed into music. I don't know how this happened. One last note about vinyl is you had this wonderful canvas on the album cover for all this artwork. You talked about the iconography. You just don't get it with a CD.
No, you don't. It's true. I mean, one of the things I do like about vinyl is that the LP, the jacket, the cover of an LP used to be a work of art. It was an art form in its own right. Much harder to replicate that on a CD, and impossible to replicate it with digital. And what I hope for the book is that the book, the physical book, will remain with us, and the hardcover books will remain with us, and they will have to become very beautiful, tactile objects for us. We'll want to display them. We'll want to put them on a shelf. And like with buying vinyl these days, if you buy an album, a new album, usually it will come with a download code so you can get it on your iPod or whatever anyway. So we'll do that with books. You know, pay a couple of bucks extra for your book, but it comes with a download code. You can put it on your e-reader. But you've also got this beautiful object, maybe slipcased, maybe limited, numbered, the stuff that bands are having to do these days. It saddens me, the thought that I might go to visit someone in their home and there will be no books on display and there'll be no records on display. How am I supposed to gauge their personality?
Yeah.
When these things, these accoutrements aren't there.
Mr. Rankin, would you autograph my iPad?
You know, you do it. I mean, people get their Kindle signed. What you do is you sign the back of the Kindle, or you sign the jacket, the cover of it.
No way.
But it just isn't the same.
Oh, dear.
I much prefer it when a member of the public comes along and wants me to autograph a part of their body.
Oh, you like that better, huh?
Depends on who it is, right?
Okay. I remember that. Okay. I'm old enough to remember those. My guest is Ian Rankin. His new novel is Standing in Another Man's Grave. It's John Rebus novel. John is back, and he's older. He is thinking about trying to get back on the force through some sort of a program that would allow him to get back on, but he's somewhat reluctant because he's going to have to take a physical, isn't he?
He would have to take a physical, and he would have to be vetted by Internal Affairs, who've got a whole shelf of stuff on him, stuff that they suspect, but they could never pin on him. So, yeah, he's... At the end of the book, we don't really know if he's been successful. I mean, the application is in, but will he succeed? That's something we'll have to wait and see. I mean, ask me again in 6 months' time, I might have a better idea.
And the crime in this one, I could not figure it out until way near the end, you really had us stumped and confused about who the perpetrator might be.
Well, there's a good reason for that, Vic. I don't know myself when I start the book. When I start the first draft, I have no idea who did it, why they did it, what's going on here. I know as little or as much as my central character, my central detective. So the first draft is a learning process for me. It's getting to know the characters, getting to know their motivations, how they connect to each other. And then towards the end of the first draft, hopefully I'll start to see some light at the end of the tunnel. And I'll think, oh, because of X, Y, and Z, it was obviously you. But I think I was 20, 30 pages from the end of the first draft of this one, and there were three or four people in my head that it could be. I still had three or four people that I thought it could be. So, yeah. So if I don't know, maybe you don't know either.
So you were in the same spot we were.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And if I don't know, then probably the reader doesn't know either. And I just trust to the muse. I trust that the novel has a sense of where it wants to go, and it will take me there.
Mm.
It will lead me there. And it could be a very different place where I end up from the place where I thought it was going to end up. Usually when I start a book, I've got some notes, but not many notes, on what I think the theme of the book is and what the plot is. But I don't know the ending, or I've got a vague notion of the ending, and I just trust that the book will show me how to get there. And the path may be a very different path from the one I envisaged when I took my original notes. But so far, touch wood, I've always ended up getting to a really interesting place at the end of the book.
Well, Ian, I have a lot of favorites among the books that you've written, but I've got to say, this new one, Standing in Another Man's Grave, really knocked me out, and this one's become one of my newest favorites.
Yeah, I was so pleased with people's reaction to it because, you know, there was some... I think there were a few doubters. There were people who thought, oh, he's just bringing Rebus back for the money, or his publisher's persuaded him to do it, or he hasn't got anything new to say about the world, so he's just going to be treading water with this thing. And it really wasn't that. It was that I got a story that I thought was very suited to Rebus, and that was the reason to bring him back, was that the story was there waiting for him. And I was terrified when I started to plot the book. I was thinking, will Rebus's voice still be there? Will he have left the building? You know, can I haven't had a 5-year hiatus? Can I still write about him?
Oh.
So the first few pages were terrifying to me. And then he stuck. You know, he's at a funeral at the start of the book, and then he sticks a cigarette in his mouth, and then he puts some music on his car hi-fi, and I thought, yeah, he's back. He never really went away.
Well, Ian, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, man.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Ian Rankin, the new one, Standing in Another Man's Grave. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Tune in next week when we visit the paranormal universe of Kim Harrison, her latest in the Hollows series, featuring vampire hunter Rachel Morgan. Is called Ever After. These books are set in Cincinnati, and they're filled with demons, vampires, pixies, witches, and werewolves. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.